children are the fuel that drives the economy even more so, because who's going to drive Eskom at the end of it? You know?
Yes, yes.
But children are not a political priority.
And from devastating droughts in southern Africa to record-breaking heat waves in South Asia, these disasters have displaced millions, disrupted education, and left children reliant on aid.
Evidence shows, both in South Africa but also globally, that if parents can get support in, you know, in for their how to care for their children in early childhood, you can really make a massive difference.
Because what we mentioned as a policy priority once in our budget policy statement. Never mind early development. Our youth dividend is recognised by economists, by decision makers as our most valuable asset. And we have simply failed to realize it. In Africa, there's going to be an estimated 1 billion children by 2050.
Sure.
We need to flick a switch for 1 billion children.
This is just one of the many stories of children across the African continent who are disadvantaged because of their circumstance. The early years of a child's life are crucial. The World Health Organization, UNICEF, and other agencies highlight the importance of nurturing care. A framework that calls for responsive care, early learning opportunities, adequate health care, nutrition and security support every child's optimal development. The Global Nurturing Care Framework promotes optimal early childhood development by supporting caregivers and communities. This initiative, aligned with global health goals, is focused on creating environments that foster children's health, nutrition, safety, early learning and responsive caregiving. Critical aspects of the framework emphasize emotional and psychological support for children from prenatal stages up to age 5. These efforts are vital as early childhood experiences significantly influence lifelong health, learning and well-being. This idea is best summed up as, if we change the beginning of the story, we change the whole story. But despite this clear understanding, millions of children in Africa face significant barriers that prevent them from thriving. To explore this complex issue, we're joined today by Patricia Martin-Wissner, a policy, organizational development, advocacy and system strengthening experts specializing in rights-based governance to build human capital for sustainable development. Hello and welcome to Our Voice, Our Future, powered by Breadline Africa, a podcast where authentic voices tell real stories and inspire change. I'm your host, Antoinette Ribello. Over the next 6 episodes, we look at children's rights, education and well-being, and what we have to do to ensure that their future is a possibility. In today's episode, we're exploring nurturing care and why it matters, especially in Africa. We focus on challenges related to children's rights and the persistent inequalities that limit a child's potential. Welcome, Patricia, and thank you for joining us. Let's start by understanding the basics. Could you give us a brief overview of the nurturing care framework and explain why it's crucial in Africa?
Great. Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity and this wonderful initiative. So the nurturing care framework is a part of a broader suite of instruments that have been developed to guide the development of childcare and protection systems to ensure that children's rights are realized and in so doing, building human capital for sustainable development. The obvious truth is that we will not have achieved sustainable development if we don't secure children's development. We will not end inequality in South Africa and the broader Africa region unless we ensure every child has an equal opportunity to thrive. And thriving, development, all of these are rights which are guaranteed by various treaty instruments, such as the Convention on the Rights of the Child and the African Charter on the Rights and Welfare of the Child. However, the instruments need to be operationalized and institutionalized through a process of governance. So South Africa ratified both the Convention of the Rights of the Child and the African Charter some 30 years ago. And in so doing, undertook to realize the rights of all children, not just to survive, but to develop their full potential so that they can become actively engaged citizens who will drive sustainability in the future. So our African development agenda, in fact, recognizes that link very closely. So what we have when we bring these two sort of pieces together, the rights and the development agendas, we have what is called a rights-based development agenda. And it is fundamentally dependent on realizing children's rights, the rights that I've mentioned. However, that is so much easier said than done. Because in order to realize children's rights to development, which is the most particularly important right when we're talking about sustainable development and transformation, is realizing those rights require, or those outcomes for children require, that all of their interdependent social, economic, civic, and political rights are realized in combination. So everybody knows children has rights, and we'll often think of the obvious ones like education or protection or water and sanitation. But the reality is that children need to have all of those real rights realized in order to develop their full potential. And that's why we call them interdependent rights. And when we start looking at how that is done in a national situation by governments, it's very complicated. Because governments do not look at the child holistically. There isn't a department of children. There's a department of water, there's a department of sanitation, there's a department of education, there's a department of health. And of course, they're not only responsible for children, they're responsible for multiple pieces. So every one of these organs of state has role to play, but they've got to act in sync, and they've got to make sure that every child receives the combination of services and support they need to realize all of their rights so that they may develop their full potential. The challenge is, there's a number of challenges, but in Africa specifically, we have a backlog, an historical legacy of large groups of marginalized families, communities, and children. This, of course, is a legacy of apartheid, of colonialism, and it is a very real legacy. And what that means is that if we look at the current situation across the region, across the sub-Saharan African region, only about 40% or of children's potential is realized. There's actually an index that's developed by the World Bank. It's called the Human Capital Index. And it looks at to what extent, they look at a number of factors. They bring all of these rights together and they do this calculation. And based on sort of a scale of 0 to 1, they measure the extent to which children's potential has been developed by the time they exit childhood at the age of 18. Score of 1, you've developed the full potential of all children. 0, nothing. The global average is 0.56.
Okay.
The sub-Saharan average is 0.4. But that is an optimistic average as well, because when you start disaggregating those outcomes based on socioeconomic status, your historically marginalized children make up the vast majority of the 60% that are not developing their full potential.
Yes, yes.
So those historical inequities have been passed down across generations. We call this the intergenerational cycle of poverty and inequality. So the challenge that we have is, how do we break that? And we know in South Africa, for example, it's really important. It's an incredibly important question, because since the transition to democracy, we've pursued a very deliberate pro-poor policy agenda, placing children at the center of that development agenda.
Yes.
And we have invested hugely in education and in health, far more than our counterparts in the sub-Saharan African region. But when we look 30 years later, we still are the most unequal country in the world, which means that we haven't achieved transformation. And the reason for this becomes very obvious when we look at what's happened to our Human Capital Index, the extent to which we've changed the life course of children in this country. We've invested hugely. We've put enormous amounts of money into education, into health, less into the other critical areas. The sub-Saharan average for the Human Capital Index is 0.4. South Africa's only 0.43. But the really alarming factor is that score has not changed in 10 years.
Sure.
We've not made any progress in those improving the overall outcomes for children. Yes, we have achieved universal primary education.
Mm-hmm.
We've reduced gender inequalities in access to education. But when we put all the pieces together, it hasn't been enough to change the story. So a country like South Africa, middle-income country, we should not be sitting with the situation. And there's many other middle-income countries in sub-Saharan Africa. Two other countries which are in a very similar situation are our fellow countries in the Southern African Customs Union. It's Lesotho and Eswatini, the Kingdom of Eswatini. Exactly the same situation. And all three of us battle with very high and persisting levels of inequality. And the reason for that, the failure to achieve transformation, the failure to break out of that negative cycle, is because of the adverse circumstances into which children are born and live in their early years. It profoundly impacts and negates their future prospects for development. The early years are the most important years. We have to get the building blocks in place. Their rights have to be realized. From conception, especially until the age of two, we call it the first 1,000 days. If we miss that, what happens is development delays accumulate and build upon each other. And what we then see, and that's exactly what we're seeing in South Africa and the broader African region, is that about between 60 and 70% of young children are not developmentally on track by the time they reach the age of five. That starts earlier, in fact, because we don't have a very good indicator for the children at the age of two. Stunting is often used as a proxy indicator.
Okay.
Stunting levels are almost at 30% in South Africa for children under the age of
two. Can you just explain that a little bit further?
Yeah, sure. So stunting is where children are too short in terms of height for the expected height at their age.
Okay.
And it's a form of chronic malnutrition, which is brought about not by hunger, but by incorrect feeding practices combined with illness and related factors, circumstances at home.
Mm.
Now, the problem with stunting is that it's the height issue is not the issue. I mean, there's many of us that are short.
Yes.
But what it is, it's when you look at the population average, it's a very clear indicator, a very good proxy indicator for delayed development or compromised development.
Mm.
Children who are stunted are developmentally delayed on average.
And just because I'm thinking, if someone's listening right now, when you say delayed development, what is the development? So what is happening between age one and two that they're delayed by?
Well, it's basically their physical, the emotional, their social, and their cognitive development. It's the development of the whole child.
Yes.
So it's your development milestones. It's the development of the senses, the hearing, the vision, the kind of the sensory perceptions.
Yes.
The coordination, but the cognitive development, the acquisition of language
and
skills.
And this does need support. So it's not that we just do.
This is something that needs to be nurtured. And we're going to get to the nurturing care framework.
Okay,
and it is developed through the interactions with the primary caregiver in those first 2 years. It depends on the quality of the care that the primary caregiver gives the child.
Absolutely.
That depends on caregivers having the knowledge and the power to provide that care. So firstly, knowing what that care is and what the consequences are is sort of the first requirement, and then providing it. But some of those elements of care cost a huge amount of money.
Yeah.
We know healthcare, hugely expensive. To feed your child a nutritious diet costs a lot of money.
Yes. And I mean, the caregiver, so let's say the mother in this case, breastfeeding, is also not really...
And so it's this. That's why we talk about this interdependence
and
how one has to look at the child holistically.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll get to the nurturing care framework in a moment. But so this that those early years of development are absolutely essential. If they are compromised in the first 1,000 days, it has an impact on the child's readiness for school.
Mm-hmm.
So children or preschool. So children will then go from the home into a preschool, but they're already deeply compromised in terms of their ability.
Yes.
Preschools are privately provided primarily in South Africa. Quality is really poor. So you have children who are already really disadvantaged going into a very poor situation. Often all they're receiving is care. They're not receiving early education where they need high-intensity education because of that previous compromised development. So we have another layer. It compounds it. And the disadvantaged are set back even further. The advantaged keep on running ahead. Then they go into school. And this is the reason why we hear these appalling statistics that by the age of 10, children cannot read for meaning. 80% of children cannot read for meaning. This has a huge impact on it, the poor early development outcomes. Then, of course, once they move into school, about 50% of children drop out before they get to grade 12. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time it's because they are not coping. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, means that they are really compromised in terms of their ability to become economically active.
Yes.
But even those who finish school, what we find is because of these deep intergenerational kind of patterns of inequity, they might develop their potential by the time they reach 18. We combine all of these. But exercising that potential is another factor that then comes into play. So it's not enough to just develop the potential. They must then become actively engaged citizens. And they've got to become active parents themselves who provide nurturing care.
Yes.
And it's primarily women who do that across the continent. And what we find is that girls do better at school. They do better on the development trajectory. But once you get to that point of transition, they get excluded because of gender inequalities, harmful customary practices, in sort of gender unfriendly labor practices.
Yes.
And what we have in the country is something called a NEET rate. It's a rate that measures the number of young people between the ages of 15 and 24 who are not in education, employment, or training. It's a very good indicator of the extent to which potential is then exercised. Mm. Once again, South Africa, a middle-income country, has a NEET rate of over 30%, and it's increased, which is really high. So that means that we're losing, you know, it's just...
What's an average on in a healthy, developed country then?
I don't want to give you an incorrect figure, no, but it's much lower. And it's probably the converse. But what's really worrying is that the majority of the people that are NEET are women. And that means that they are, and they're excluded largely because of their caregiving roles and responsibilities. And what that does is it starts that whole generational problem again because they can't earn, have babies. And what compromises the ability to provide nurturing care is not just lack of knowledge, but there's a range of adverse circumstances which are particularly unique in the African context. And they deeply compromise the capacity for parents, especially mothers, to provide nurturing care. To know what that nurturing care is and to provide it. And it's factors like poverty, toxic stress, substance abuse, the enormously high levels of domestic violence and abuse that we have. So there's a large number of women, in fact, it's the majority of women, experience what is called toxic stress. And this toxic stress is pervasive and it's lifelong and it affects the development of the fetus. It starts from conception. Yeah. It rewires the brains of the babies, and that's where the development starts. You know, in South Africa, we will all, and I think many other African countries, we all very much were worried about making sure Eskom worked. So that we could generate electricity so we could drive our economy.
Yes.
And that has always been the number one issue or the number one priority in all our national development plans, in our budgets, that source, that fuel that's going to drive our economy.
Mm-hmm.
Children are the fuel that drives the economy even more so, because who's going to drive Eskom at the end of it, you know?
Yes, yes.
But children are not a political priority.
No.
And we speak the speak. The evidence is there, but when it comes to the nub of the matter, if you look at our latest budget, National Medium-Term Budget Policy Statement here in South Africa, children are not mentioned as a policy priority once in our budget policy statement. Never mind early development. But in bulk infrastructure development, electricity generation, all of those issues are mentioned. And
why do you think that is? It's because obviously those generate income.
But well,
they can see the income.
I think that's the million of the children.
I mean, it's all one of those things you're investing in. It's almost, I think it's similar. And I'm really just thinking out loud here. But it makes me think of like when you take out a life policy or you take out one of those financial, you take out a fund or something that's you're not going to be able to experience. It's not for you. It's difficult to part with that money. Do you know what I mean? I think people can't wrap their heads around that you might need, disability facility, but you're not, just because you haven't had the accident, you just don't think it's important. Do you think it's maybe similar to that? Like where we can, Eskom electricity in the country, you know, affects our business on a day-to-day basis. Mm. And so for us, that makes sense to then, you know, complain about and invest in. And so you've got all these corporates and you know, just normal individuals kind of seeing the importance in that. But children, especially if they're not children you see on a day-to-day basis and they're not yours.
So that's a very complicated question. Yeah. I mean, if we had the answer, we would be sitting having this conversation.
Absolutely,
because
yeah.
the science is so robust and so clear.
Yes.
Invest early and we will change the story.
Yes.
The long-term story. And I don't think it is even a case that we can't see the immediate results, because we are seeing a situation where we've got one of, on the continent, the highest youth unemployment rates. Mm. Our youth dividend is recognized by economists, by decision makers as our most valuable asset. And we have simply failed to realize it.
Sure.
You know, 60% of the youth dividend in the, on the African continent is not realized. And that asset is sitting unemployed, not generating taxes, mm-hmm. not building the economy, and in fact, increasing the future size of that proportion that are not actively engaged. So the numbers already are there.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's that simple. The science is very clear. I think it's a matter of politics
yes.
and political will. Children don't vote.
Yes.
So they're not. There's not an immediate kind of linkage between kind of the electoral mandate and children. There is a lot of ignorance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this might be controversial, but I think there's too many men running the world.
That is not controversial.
They are just completely, they have
no,
a
I mean,
different.
Put a lot more mothers on the table there.
Women.
Absolutely.
And this is why when we talk about transformation, we need women in leadership.
Yes.
Who bring a broader perspective to the understanding around social, economic, political and civic development.
Yes. No, I say mothers only because, you know, personally, you know, when you describe child development, until I had my own child, you know, witnessing how much happens in 1 year is very difficult to explain to someone.
Yes.
I think it's almost something that until you've witnessed how much a child develops physically, emotionally, like all of it, you know, it's one thing saying it and it's another thing witnessing it. But I do, I agree with you, all women. I mean, it's instinctive for us, right?
So. Absolutely. And I think we tap into a different set of skills and knowledge and kind of empathies when we make decisions.
Yes.
So there's a multiple reasons, but I think largely it's around the complexity of governance. There isn't a magic switch. It's not like Eskom that you literally can flip a switch and put it on.
Yes.
To change the life course for, in Africa, there's going to be an estimated 1 billion children by 2050.
Sure.
We need to flick a switch for 1 billion children. Mm. So, and of those, there's about 100 million that are not developing their full potential. So it's the scale and the complexity of the solution that needs to be operationalized through governance structures or government structures. And that's where the complexity comes in, because we need all of these different role players to understand what it is that needs to be provided to address these risks to nurturing care in all households.
When you say all these, what departments are you speaking about?
So it would be, there probably is not one department or one organ of state that doesn't have a role to play.
Okay.
So, you know, there's obviously the obvious ones, health, social development, home affairs, education, but there's transport, there's agriculture, there's environment, trade and industry, labor. I mean, we're talking about breastfeeding and, you know, sort of parental rights in the workplace. I mean, there is not one. Parliament has a critical role to play in oversight. Local governments have a critical role to play in providing basic services, registration of centres, quality control, making safe spaces. So this is, it is a whole of government and a whole of society responsibility. So what we really need is very strong leadership, and that's one of the challenges.
Yes.
We need vocal, visible leadership that children's development is a national development priority. The way we have prioritized reducing unemployment, we need to see an equal priority placed on improving children's development outcomes. But we do need very strong leadership. We have that leadership for our other national development priorities. We don't have this problem for, well, we haven't managed to reduce unemployment hugely.
No, but
it is on everybody's radar.
Yeah, exactly, yes.
And we have this wonderful, and across the continent, most countries have established these lovely governance arrangements and architecture to provide that leadership and drive government-wide mainstreaming and use of resources to provide their piece of the puzzle. And then overall, we monitor the big outcome. And I'm thinking of, for example, things like reduced unemployment, reduced NEET rates, for example.
Yes.
But we don't have that for children. We don't have it adequately for children.
Yes.
There are little snatches and there are promising examples, but they get left behind. Mm. So we need to make sure that children's development, not just children.
Because yes. Do you think that there's a large focus on education?
Too much.
Yeah, I think when people think the problem with Africa is education, it's almost like the answer is just put a whole bunch of books in every school and we'll solve the poverty issue.
Well, that's it, right. Yeah. That statistic that I quoted earlier on, yes. We've got one of the highest ratios of education budget in relation to GDP.
Sure.
But our education outcomes are so poor and our development outcomes haven't changed in 10 years.
Yeah.
So, and this is the challenge. And even when it comes to early child development, there's been a lot of new policies and new initiatives, but they focus on early childhood education.
Education is always one of the main things that we think about when we think about how are we going to save the children. Mm. You know, I definitely am someone that I have a strong focus. I mean, I am someone that's a product of education, really. I'm originally from the Congo. My parents moved to South Africa in 1994. And yeah, my parents' sole focus was education. Thankfully, they didn't get the education. So it wasn't something that they had. My dad was an entrepreneur and I'm one of eight. So I'm number eight. And yeah, I think every single one of my siblings would say that education is the difference, you know, between maybe the life we would have had and the life we have now. But I also think, like you say, it was environment. We were 1994, we were able to be in an environment where my parents could look after us without fear. We left a war-torn country and into a country that wasn't experiencing, you know, war. My mom had support. She had a village, you know, and I think that I was raised by more than one woman, you know, and I think I always, I'm a big, big, big fan of help. Mm. You know, I'm a mother and I mean, I have hands... Praise to women that do it on their own, but I definitely, being raised by more than one woman, I know the importance of that village. But nurturing, like you say, I'm really excited to hear more about this because I'm carrying my second child. My daughter's almost three. Her development was really, really something I never really understood until I watched it. I mean, something as simple as her neck, you know, I know it's something, you don't think about it, but one day it's wobbling and the next it's literally like turning its head. And then also just, you know, her hand-eye coordination, her speech, all of that. And you read and you're on social media and you're just bombarded with all the different things that you need to be doing. Otherwise, your child is not going to be Einstein. And there's a lot of pressure on mothers out there. But I really, I can definitely say that she is, without a doubt, stronger because she had myself, my husband, and a lot of attention in the first 2 years, like you said. But yeah, so I mean, I'm interested because we haven't even got to the education side yet with her, you know. So, but I agree with you. I think that she isn't afraid, you know, to learn.
Yeah,
there's a lot of confidence, and that is because she's had safety. You know, there hasn't been any interruption in her safety. So when you know, you talk about what are those important aspects that a child needs to experience. She's been fed. When she hasn't eaten, there is no learning. You know, we will have tantrums but it's immediate. You go down the list of things. Yeah. Why is she behaving like this? Oh, maybe she's hungry. Oh, maybe she's, but you know, luckily we can answer those things. Maybe she needs to sleep. Maybe she, and there is someone thinking about that so that she's able to then learn. I can, from a personal experience, I know that if I didn't think about food, maybe she needs to sleep, all those things, then my child would be just unable to develop.
And you've summed up the nurturing care framework in a nutshell there. I mean, you actually answered the very first question that you started with. But so there is this focus on education. Education is one of the critical components. It's not to undermine its importance. It is absolutely vital. But on its own, it's not enough. And I just wanted to point out something that you said, you know, you haven't yet gotten to the education part. Actually, you have. You've been doing that since your baby was born. Because they start learning, in fact, in the womb. And this is one of the big other problems, is that learning doesn't start once children enter a center or a school. Learning starts from the moment of conception. The brain starts developing. And that is what, that is the shift that we're needing to start seeing in homes. Mm-hmm. Because that early learning is one of the five components of nurturing care. And it's simple things like reading to your child, making eye contact with your child, this responsive caregiving, which you've just explained so beautifully. Why is my child having a meltdown? Because they need sleep or they are hungry. It's responding to their cues. Mm. And all of that is quite natural. And the other biggest asset next to the youth dividend is the natural capacity for nurturing that women have. Mm. Every woman wants the best for her child. And it comes naturally and instinctively. But sort of circumstances around us prevent us often from fulfilling that. And then when we have these additional adversities, like poverty, violence in the home, lack of support. Mm. You don't have someone to look after your baby. You've got to go to work. You might be having the baby blues. You might have postnatal depression.
I was about to say,
Very high levels of postnatal depression on the continent. Who do you turn to?
Yeah.
So really all we are saying is that this is actually common sense. The science has now plotted it and said, actually, now we prove that the common sense is actually real. But the problem is that 80% of families, parents in lower and middle income countries face so many intersecting adversities that their capacity for nurturing care is deeply compromised. They simply cannot do it. And the state responsibility, and this is in terms of treaties, the treaties that I mentioned earlier on, and our own policies, our National Child Care and Protection Policy, our ECD policy, the state's duty is to provide an essential suite of services and support to parents to enable them to provide nurturing care, and is to compensate for those risks. So what we have in South Africa, for example, is an amazing social security system that reaches almost all the poor families and children in the country, but it's made no difference to the human capital index.
Yeah.
Because just throwing money at the problem is not going to solve the problem. You need to create nurturing environments. And to do this, we need to bring all of these services together and they need to be accessed. So what the nurturing care framework is, it's a framework that's taken all this evidence and has provided a governance roadmap for governments on how do you then translate or operationalize these responsibilities using your governance architecture, using your own systems. And what do we start with? So we start with ensuring leadership and coordination, which will then lead to increasing recognition of this support for nurturing care as a national budget priority. And that will then trickle down because as soon as you have it in your national development plan, as soon as you have it in something like a medium-term development plan, children and their development are important. It will automatically be picked up in your national budget policy statements. And that is what guides statewide governance and priority. So we don't have to be going to every one of the departments.
Mm.
If we manage to
create awareness of what we're about to do.
Well, but an accountability so that there's this very clear statement that this is a whole of government and a whole of society responsibility.
Yes.
And you as different government departments have roles and responsibilities and you have to account for your contribution to this.
Absolutely.
And then it gets built into, we put in indicators into our governance system. We make sure that budgets are available. But without that leadership, we can't see this organic kind of systems alignment.
Mm.
And that's really one of the big challenges across the continent.
Do you think there is a system that has done that?
Yes.
Has there been an example of something else?
Chile. Basically, what happened was you had a head of state who recognized this as a priority, restructured governance, made children's development a priority, and there was a massive transformation in priorities and services that were provided, and there was a substantial shift in outcomes for children.
Okay.
Because suddenly there was coordinated governance. Now, so we talk about leadership and then coordination, because we need to have, we've got to have one common unifying goal that galvanizes yes. all of us. It's improving development outcomes for children. But then we've got to have the coordination of the systems of all the different organs of state so that they fit together neatly to create a nice tapestry, a network of services and support. And that coordination is something that has to be done systemically.
Mm.
It's not something that happens through coordination structures. So everybody talks about establishing coordination structures. Coordination is actually a political act. It's the execution of a political mandate. So what happens in most countries is you will have coordination structures set up around children, and you will have multiple coordination structures set up, but it's often meetings. People come to meetings and various people come to different meetings. They're low-level, mid-management people. They have no political authority.
Yes.
There's no mandate for them to act. And people are running themselves ragged going to meetings, trying to coordinate. But coordination has to happen at a political level. So you need this political commitment to improve children's development through this unified sort of network of services. And then all the ministries, they've got to have ministerial execution of that mandate through departmental structures.
Okay.
So that's how the governance system yeah. works. But you need that leadership.
Yeah.
And then the coordination will follow. And then so the nurturing care framework is really a governance roadmap. It says this is the evidence. Your returns on investment. So just, I mean, there's numbers involved. So Hickman's studies, and he did quite a lot of studies in America and Jamaica, looking at sort of across generations, what were the changes when we invested in early child development? So they calculated what the return on every dollar spent would be if you just provided early education.
Okay.
For 3-year-olds and up. And the return on investment was about 7%, which is not a bad return.
Yeah.
But what they then did is they did a comparative assessment and said, okay, if we increase that care and we start from conception and we provide this integrated comprehensive support in addition to the early education, we double our returns. We go from 7 to 13%. Sure. So the economists, the numbers are there.
Yeah.
It's not that it's not immediately realizable yes. and immediately tangible. But it's not shaping, it hasn't been influencing how the decisions are made. So the nurturing care framework tries to bring this together, but it's a framework. It doesn't have any legal status,
mm-hmm.
but what it does is it explains what children need in order to develop their full potential, explains the enormous potential for equalizing these intergenerational inequalities that we've seen.
Yes.
Because we are able to equalize opportunities if we have appropriate responsive services. So it positions nurturing care and this package of 5 very basic ingredients: health, nutrition, responsive caregiving, early learning, and safety and protection. That's all children need.
Yeah.
And they will thrive.
Yeah, and they will. Yeah.
It's a simple formula. How do we get there? And it provides that roadmap. But it is not a legal instrument, not like a treaty or yes. even, the development agenda. No one's monitoring it. Well, there is monitoring, but it's nobody is accountable for that. So it's, whether or not it's operationalized is very much up. Once again, it's a political decision. It's a leadership decision. And this is where civil society is working very actively to get the nurturing care framework institutionalized. Into governance architecture in states so that we can start seeing improved support to parents to enable nurturing care.
I just wanted to ask you to give maybe a practical example of, so if we're looking at those 5 examples, so maybe it's a practical, so what does the responsive care look like to
sure.
a person on the ground? So I'm a mother in a situation that's, maybe I've just felt pregnant. How does the country respond to me and the child? Like, how do we then attack that section?
So that, so we all know that health is important. So, but I'm going to answer it by just giving examples
yeah.
from some of these. So,
yes.
So we all know that health is important. And government knows that health is important, but often we just then think about, well, children must just survive. So we make sure they get the immunizations and they go to the hospital if they've got diarrhea. But we forget about healthy development, monitoring development milestones, vision screening, hearing screening, checking for development delays, early interventions. Mm-hmm. So that would be sort of a health, a health element to the health domain.
Okay.
And obviously, parents can't do that on their own. They need the knowledge. And the kind of support that would be necessary is through the health system. So that the health system doesn't just ensure babies survive, but that they thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole lot of commitments that have been made around that. So, but parents need to know that those services are available, and the services must be available and of a quality and accessible. Nutrition is really complex because it's not just about, you know, severe malnutrition. It's not about wasting. It's also about this chronic malnutrition, the stunting, and understanding what this actually means and how you can change or prevent it from happening. And it is about, you know, we have a very high sort of the dietary diversity or the proportion of children who receive the required dietary diversity to ensure optimal growth and development. It's very low. It's about 13%. Because we have poor sort of families, poor economies. It's easier. You go and buy a big bag of Mealy Meal, you feed your babies and your children pop, with a bit of gravy and maybe some meat as you go later on down the line. So it's about education as well, parental support and education through the health system while you're pregnant, having discussions, conversations, reaching out, having your network of support know about nutrition, know that exclusive breastfeeding is the best way around that. But then when we get to exclusive breastfeeding, and this is where responsive care comes in, because they're not separate.
Yes.
Feeding on demand is a form of responsive caregiving.
Yes.
You take your cues from your baby. You take your cues from your child. Children are kind of preset to let you know what they need in order to develop and to thrive.
Mm-hmm.
So babies will let you know when they are ready to feed. Co-sleeping, for example, is a form of responsive caregiving so that your baby feels comfort and support and security. Engaging with your baby, speaking to your baby, making eye contact with your baby. If your child is having a particularly sort of temper tantrum, there's a reason for it. But children are not naughty.
Yes.
There's a reason for it. And it's being able to respond to that. But if you're under incredible stress, you're probably going to want to whack your baby rather than actually now sit back. And you're not going to have the capacity to sort of really deal with this in a calm way. Responsive, but you need this network of support around you. All women need that network of support. So you have the baby, you need to have parental leave. So that you have those 3 months.
Yeah, I was going to say, how do you do the breastfeeding if you have to be at work?
But apart from that, those first 3 months are so important for that bond.
Yeah.
That bond that is established, that's critical to responsive caregiving. And that's why
I'm sure that it's like paid leave is not a thing when you, maternity leave is not necessarily paid. So, I mean, there's a lot of women
in South Africa,
it
is. So it is if you've contributed, but that's only in the formal economy. If you're in the informal economy, it's not.
No, that's what I mean. Yeah. So the majority of people are unpaid maternity leave. So then
when you do go to work, we have something called, we have a set of laws which support your right to breastfeed in the workplace. But I did a bit of a review a couple of years ago. And I mean, I'd phone companies, especially the smaller ones, and they'd say to me, are you serious? You're joking? Is this real? I must make some space for someone to breastfeed.
Yeah.
You know?
No, so, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I mean, there we go.
Yeah, we go. So, you know, and this is why we talk about supporting and creating enabling environments.
Yes.
And that's government responsibility. Yes. Early education, it starts from birth.
Yes.
Mothers and fathers are the first teachers.
Yes.
But they need the capacity to do that. Singing songs, telling stories. You don't have to be read. You don't have to be literate to be but you need to know, be conscious that what you are doing makes a difference to the development of your child. And you need to be doing all of it in combination.
So from what I understand, you know, and I love that you said it's every single department that needs to understand the importance of nurturing children.
Yeah.
Because when I think of where I could have learned that, you know, just the little things I learn now being a mother could have even happened at school. I mean, there could have been one day of this. You know, I mean, you could have like a workshop that happens. That's compulsory. And there you go. Now you've heard it. It's in your memory. and you fall pregnant and someone said you must look at your child and make eye contact and you remember that that's important.
Well, yeah, that is when we talk about systemic solutions.
Yeah.
So now we have this backlog of parents who are incapable and we keep on trying to run parenting workshops. We're never going to reach the parents of this billion children. We're not. The only way we're going to reach them is reach them before they become parents and through the school system. Child development should be in sort of part of the examinable curriculum. We really need to institutionalize this. Our education system needs to prepare children to be actively engaged citizens in the 21st century. Part of being an actively engaged citizen is providing nurturing care as a good parent.
What about the person listening to this right now? Or myself as a mother and about to have another child. What can we do today, you know, to contribute to what you're saying and to see this become future plans?
There's so much we can do. So the beauty of the nurturing care framework is it talks about an ecosystem of care. It starts with the child, moves to the parents, moves to the family, to the community, and then we start getting national, regional, and international governance structures. So much can happen at the epicenter of that ecosystem. If we understand what nurturing care is and we provide that nurturing care, inform ourselves, educate ourselves, but critically strengthen those care environments by extending that network of support, by providing support, by being supportive to each other. And it's quite simple. Just making sure that we have the support that we need and we provide the support, that parents and caregivers don't have to make difficult decisions about, do I give my child food today or do I send them to school? Or do I go to work today or is my child going to be safe? There is so much we can do at the individual level, at the family level, and at the community level to strengthen and make much safer, more nurturing environments available.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Patricia. Thank you to our listeners for joining in today. If you enjoyed our episode, please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and share. Join us for another essential conversation about children's well-being. Until then, thank you. Take care.